The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. A United States of Europe is forming. We're going to live on over into the time of a complete and total change in the entirety of geopolitical structure in the world. We are even now seeing a demand for reappraisal and reassessment of American policy around the world, with the ignominious retreat and withdrawal from Vietnam, and after Vietnam, a new era of uncertainty. And right now, especially inside Central Europe and with the upcoming NATO summit conference and arrival of Gerald Ford there to try to shore up weakened trust and faith in U.S. protection for Europe, in any United States of America involvement in Europe, Mr. Ford will make some public statements, but privately those statements may not be believed or accepted. Very likely I will be on the spot at that time. We're arranging tentatively some conferences which I will report to you on the radio with the Secretary General of NATO, the top man of all of NATO forces. And I also understand we're being given an interview with the Prime Minister of Belgium, and also the one man, a British gentleman, who is at the helm of the entire structure for the European defense posture of an upcoming European military force. We'll be reporting from on the spot while those developments are happening. But first, notice what is happening right now. Even in the light of American resolve in the hijacked ship Mayaguez and our almost immediate response to Mr. Ford's calculated risk in sending Marines, Naval, and Air Force forces into that area off Cambodia, we were signaling to the world we were not yet a pitiful, helpless giant, but maybe it's a little shocking to realize that in spite of that, many of the strategists, the top people inside Western Europe, the policy planners, who are shaping and forming coming European policy, are privately convinced that the United States of America can no longer be considered a reliable ally. It isn't necessarily the goodwill of the president they question. It's the mood of the American people, and it's the mood of the American Congress. That's what makes Europeans apprehensive. One little success in the midst of hundreds of reversals, in the midst of a complete obvious downward trend, in the midst of the writing off, virtually, of Portugal, because that's the way we looked at it until we saw that the communists only gained about a 13% minority, and apparently we had a little bit of a hopeful sign with the Portuguese elections. But the way the United States is being pushed around, everywhere you look around the world, whether you look in the Arab states or Iran or Greece or Turkey, NATO partners of ours, and the way the United States has proved to lack resolve and to lack will and be willing to compromise even with our A-bomb treaty with the Soviet Union, has Europeans worried. They are convinced that the United States of America can no longer be considered a reliable ally. Now, the upcoming NATO summit conference, only days after you hear this broadcast, taking place in Brussels at NATO headquarters, is going to be a very important one. We're liable to hear a lot of very powerful words at the NATO summit conference about the future of that organization. Right now, the neutralist wind is stirring everywhere in the world. First, we began to see the worldwide domino effect, which had been predicted clear back during the Eisenhower administration. And sure enough, almost immediately, some of the remaining Southeast Asian peripheral countries, among them Thailand, and, of course, Malaysia, Singapore, and the Philippines, have formed a new organization called ASEAN, A-S-E-A-N, and they have signaled to the communist Chinese and to all of the other communist states, Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam, that they intend to pursue a neutralist course in that part of the world. Now we see neutralist winds stirring inside Europe in very much the same fashion, because European leaders have subconsciously decided that they are not going to depend anymore on the nuclear umbrella of the United States, that they may have to depend only upon themselves. And it's not just our retreat in Indochina that has shocked Western Europe. It is a great deal more. It is the defeatism and the isolationism and the current mood of the American people, and more specifically the mood of our American Congress, that has the Europeans a little bit jumpy. Around Europe's corridors of power, many still believe in the American commitment, and many policy planners might really believe Gerald Ford means exactly what he says, and that his public insistence that he will not unilaterally abandon the continent means what it says. A day or so before this broadcast, Henry Kissinger was telling the people of Berlin that we will not abandon Berlin, and he harked back to the days of the Berlin airlift and the time when President Kennedy visited and said, "Ich bin ein Berliner," and was so popular, and how Berlin is to be, in that sense, the acid test of American involvement inside Europe. So right now, Gerald Ford and Henry Kissinger are both trying to shore up flagging spirits and perhaps growing doubts inside the West European community about American promises, about American will, American strength, and American resolve. But in private, those same people who listen to all the speechmaking believe that Ford and any future president, no matter what he wants to do himself, will be unable to make those promises stick. It was clear back in 1973 when Congress passed the War Powers Resolution that gave the president power to end any American military action within any 60-day period, that the Europeans began to take a little bit of notice. The subsequent congressional insistence on taking away from our president his traditional power to conduct foreign policy without checking first with the Congress has made Europeans fear. Now that happened because of the mood of America, the Vietnam War protests, the incredible unpopularity in the last stages of that war in the public mind, and of course during the Nixon administration, where the secret bombing of Cambodia came out. And so it was a seemingly logical choice inside the United States, but the effect on Europe was little known by our people. It's amazing to me how little we pay attention to Europe, how little is really known about it in the American press. The media pays almost no attention to Europe, to the unbelievable power that is there, the gradual, continual, constant move toward full European political union, the gradual move toward a third huge nuclear power force, a third power block in the world between the communists on one hand and the United States on the other. We fail to realize how badly the communist Chinese government wants to see a powerful, strong Europe as a continued threat to the Soviet Union because of communist Chinese and communist Soviet difficulties. And of course, the communist Chinese would like to see massive Soviet divisions in Eastern Europe and along in European Soviet areas, rather than massed along the Chinese border. As a matter of fact, the leader of Belgium just recently visited with the communist Chinese leader Mao Zedong and came back, and I hope to talk with him in a very few days. But it's time for us to wake up and realize that Europe is going to be where all the news occurs, between Europe and the Middle East. That's where it's all going to really concern the United States in the years just ahead of us. Our minds have been focused almost entirely for more than a decade on Vietnam. Our news, all during that time, was focused on the domino theory and on communism in Southeast Asia and on American military involvement in a land war in Asia. But a staggering turn in world events is due to erupt, and it's going to violently involve the United States and Britain and Western Europe and the Middle East. And we've been saying that on this program for so many years, it's almost hard to recollect. I've been saying it myself for 20 years on this broadcast. We have been predicting that a United States of Europe would come. And we were saying it back during the dark days of 1946 when other world leaders said Europe would not rise again, that Germany in particular would never rise again. Others said not in 50 years. That was Sir Winston Churchill's own appraisal when he visited Europe, Western Europe, and saw the unbelievable destruction wrought by American and British bombers during World War II. This program, The World Tomorrow, was saying Germany will rise again. And back during the 50s, when almost no one knew what was going on there, our plain truth was reporting Germany will rise again. She will become one of the biggest industrial and eventually one of the biggest military powers the world has ever seen. I don't know if it's 0.001% of the American population who understand that the West German arms and munitions makers are in business again. I doubt very much if anyone, except a precious few who might read some of the aviation publications, understand that the West Germans are turning out supersonic fighters, that they're turning out medium-range bombers, that they're turning out tanks and guns, and that they are rearming. I don't think people in the United States know that. I think they just look at Germany as a nice, docile, wonderful ally, just deeply grateful to the United States. You know, when you travel over there, you talk to the people. Yes, it's true, you've got a whole new generation, but there's both good and bad news to report about that. Many people say because we've got a new generation in West Germany, we should totally forget the past. Don't ever say that to the people of Israel. Don't ever say that to the Jewish community of some of the cities who have experienced recent desecrations of Jewish graveyards that have happened since World War II. And don't ever say that to others who have been virtually devoting their lives to warning about what yet might occur for another time in modern world history inside Western Europe and inside Germany in particular. But it's both good and bad. It is true there is a new generation. But that generation has been educated in two ways. Number one, in an experimental democracy, that West German generation has been educated with an almost huge question mark, a giant gap, a whole missing generation in their knowledge or their mind, in their history books, in their textbooks, which left out, or which just glossed over, which paid almost no attention to the Hitler era. Now there is coming a kind of a reaction to that. And in the West German newsstands today, in motion pictures, and in comic book type publications, especially some pictorial type publications, there is a flurry of interest all of a sudden in the younger generation in the Nazi era. Now newsstands are just flooded with all kinds of books and journals and especially paperbacks and pictorial magazines that are really showing the glories and the excitement and the wonderment of the Nazi era. And the stirrings of German military might are beginning to occur again. Now, West Germans were very anxious to hear an authoritative rebuff by the United States to the Soviet contention that Big Four agreements give the United States, Britain, and France no rights whatsoever in East Berlin. That Soviet contention, by the way, was set forth in a note that was sent to Secretary General Kurt Waldheim of the United Nations only about a week ago. The three Western powers had told Waldheim in April that their World War II rights and responsibilities in East Berlin remain in force. But you know, even though Secretary of State Henry Kissinger gave the communists another warning not to draw wrong conclusions from their conquest in South Vietnam, he could have said a great deal more. He reportedly viewed the former German capital as a perfect place to make a statement on America's fidelity to its friends, as well as the need for further detente between Washington and Moscow. And that's fine, as far as it goes. The official statements being made now, the ones I expect to hear from Gerald Ford in person at NATO headquarters, are that the United States intends to fulfill its commitments to its allies. I think Mr. Ford intends that. I was particularly incensed, however, to hear those words coming at the launching of America's new supercarrier. On the very days, during the very moments and the minutes when the final dismemberment of Vietnam was underway, to say, we will honor our commitments, we will not abandon our friends. Well, Europeans began to worry a little when the American Congress took away from the American president the right to wage war, to begin or to end any military action on his own. And so Congress passed that War Powers Resolution back in 1973. Now, that is virtually removing the nuclear umbrella, as the Europeans might see it, from Western Europe. And increasingly, Europeans are expecting to go it alone. As they see it, the United States has been giving in everywhere around the world. They saw the United States give in, thinking nothing could be done to stop a country like Portugal from going under the communist spell. They see that the United States has virtually written off Italy and Greece as being unable to do anything about both of those countries being absorbed into a communist-like government. Many people privately behind the scenes in Europe go so far as to say that the United States no longer sees its security even tied to the survival of any democracy in Europe. Because with detente, with friendliness with the Soviet Union, with trade and cultural exchanges, with ping-pong diplomacy warming up toward China, Europe begins looking a little bit edgily and a little bit uncomfortably around at its own borders and wondering, what are we doing? Here is America, the giant, that on the one hand is taking slaps and kicks and abrasive language and abuse all around the world, notwithstanding the Mayaguez incident. And on the other hand, here is the European unity momentum dying out a little bit. We got an article in the current number of The Plain Truth that covers that about Jean Monnet at 86, who was called the father of Europe, and whether or not the governments of Europe are really moving as fast as they had hoped originally toward European Union. And so, I remember the words of Franz Josef Strauss, who said that West Germany and Europe, viewed in the context of a divided Germany, because Europe itself is divided, had become, in the post-war years, through its reindustrialization, through its strong economic base, an economic and an industrial giant, but he called them a political dwarf. And I think that's well put, because that is the way it is in your thinking, isn't it? In your own private thinking, there isn't a person in the United States who, if he saw some big statement made by the West German Prime Minister, would really worry about it very much. It's just of no real consequence. The average American is just not really aware, isn't apprehensive, isn't worried, isn't even concerned, is not aware of what is going on inside Central Europe. And yet to emerge there is going to eventually come a huge military power that is going to absolutely shock your mind. It's going to boggle your mind when you realize the ultimate power that will emerge in Central Europe. Europe's military might right now may not appear to be credible to a lot of people. But while America's military might has been shrinking, the Soviet Union has been steadily growing. While our fleet, composed mostly of tired 20-year-plus-old vessels and a sixth fleet in the Mediterranean, is in that sense of the word, because of its aging and because of the increase of the deployment of Soviet vessels, the balance of power has shifted rather markedly. The opening of the Suez Canal, by the way, is going to facilitate very dramatically Russian fleet units into the Indian Ocean, as Britain has been forced to pull back and has become the sick man of Europe and a third-rate power, and we predicted that in this program many, many years before it happened. We foretold the fall of the British Empire. We have shown that that was going to occur years and years, a decade and more, before anybody ever suspected it would. The British economic sickness, the sickness of spirit, the lack of resolve, the pullbacks around the world, the fact that they were simply going on the rocks, all kinds of articles over years have occurred in The Plain Truth saying that would happen. And as Britain has pulled back from its status of empire and patrolling the seas of the world, barely able now, presumably, to defend the Thames estuary, the Soviet Union has grown. And along with that, so has Europe. Now the Soviets are increasing their military capability by 5 to 10% a year in Europe. And so West European strategists have begun to feel absolutely powerless. They feel they need to beef up their own forces and to strike some kind of a firm defense posture. Now, military buildup is going to perhaps divert an awful lot of money. And the European inflation problem has affected its military preparedness, made it all but impossible for them to afford the arms. So you're going to see some dramatic upheavals, all right, because of the price of Arab oil, because of the threatened loss of newfound prosperity, which could divert some of the monies that are channeled into political hands in a very unsavory quarters inside Western Germany in particular. And right now, there is a neutralist shift underway in Central Europe. Many politicians from European centers have been visiting in communist capitals. For instance, Belgium's king, Baudouin, and the Queen of Denmark, Marguerite, are scheduled to make state visits to Moscow. Those will be the first reigning European monarchs to travel to the Kremlin since the Communist Revolution occurred, clear back in 1917. And you know, some of those behind the scenes, not only in NATO, but even outside and within some of the countries of Central Europe, are really a little bit worried about the American Congress and the American mood today. They see how the Soviets are exploiting every conceivable opportunity. They see how the United States has been kicked out of Southeast Asia. They see other countries going neutralist and warning the United States that they're going to lose bases, such as even the Philippines. People have thought of the Philippines almost like a possession of the United States. The long, incredible friendship, the total and utter dependency of the Philippines upon the United States, and our huge bases, Clark Air Force Base there, for example, and our huge naval installations there, now in very serious jeopardy. And the Europeans see this, and it's not lost upon them when they see that we were unable to do anything about Greece or Turkey, about communist gains in Italy, about the threat of communism in Portugal. And the communists, in the meantime, had poured about $45 million into the coffers of the Communist Party in Portugal, trying to help them put it over. So, to the Europeans, they see a lot of naivete in the West, that this détente is a good thing, is desirable for the Americans. It means an end to the Cold War. But viewed from Europe, they see the Soviet Union grabbing this as a vehicle for intensification of their struggle against the Western social system of democracy and access, even through diplomatic, cultural, social, and economic means, to subvert and to continue to overthrow Western European governments. The Europeans view Soviet military might in the Mediterranean as an incursion into the soft underbelly of Europe. The Europeans view the United States backing down around the world as lack of resolve and of making the United States military might very much incredible, not credible at all, and so they're beginning to take steps to do something about it. Well, I have said for so many years in this broadcast that a United States of Europe is coming, and the stage is being set very dramatically for that right now. All world events seem to affect every other world event somewhere, so that what happens far off in Vietnam affects very definitely what happens in European governments. And what happens in the Mayaguez incident, that affects other governments around the world. We need to understand exactly where we are in the light of Bible prophecy, because Bible prophecy does specifically talk about a 10-nation combine, a 10-nation union. I don't know how those nations are going to be counted and out of which context they will arise. They could arise out of the EEC, the European Economic Community, of which Americans seem to know almost nothing. They could arise out of the shambles of it. They could arise out of a completely different organization of some sort. Euratom, or the European Coal and Steel Community, or a completely separate pact of some type which could be signed. Now, right now, there are 9 nations in the European Economic Community, but that includes the nation of Britain. It may not stay in, or she may until the last moment. It's hard to predict one way or the other, but the Bible specifically mentions 10 great leaders which will form what the Bible calls a great beast, merely looking at an analogy of a huge animal. And as a matter of fact, in the book of Daniel, the 7th chapter, the ancient Roman Empire, which trampled underfoot and destroyed wherever it went, is depicted as just such a huge beast. And what is pictured in the 17th chapter of the book of Revelation as a great beast that is actually held sway by a great supranational religious organization is nothing but an end time resurrection of that same basic system. Oh, it's modern, it's space age, it's armed with nuclear weapons, it's an end-time organization of 10 nations that is called a beast, but it's prophesied in the Bible to emerge virtually out of the rubble of that ancient old empire. And what we may not realize is that even what Hitler and Mussolini put together was called the Holy Roman Empire. That's what it was called, not widely publicized, but it was certainly known by those during the early parts of World War II, and it was so called by the people on the spot themselves. That's what Mussolini called it. You need to understand how close we are to monumental global events which could introduce the emergence of a United States of Europe. Maybe it'll be called Etage Europe Unie, I don't know, in the French, and there's the idea of a new monetary standard. Now, you know that the Bible talks about a mysterious mark of that beast, and isn't it at least interesting in passing that two of the major currencies of Europe, actually 3, are called by the name mark. Actually, the word franc in French merely means mark, means stamped impress.
like struck on a coin. It is a mark that is marked on a coin. That's all in the world it means. In the German language, it's called a mark, and it means exactly that. There was an ancient French coin years ago that was called an écu, E-C-U. And so they are taking the idea from that and taking the letters that that might signify, like Europe Commune Unie, and saying that might be the monetary standard for the European community, or the United States of Europe, whatever it's called, and they might call the money the AQ. They are, by any comparison, much stronger economically than the United States in balance of payments, deficits, any way you want to measure it, even though they are, in that sense of the word, at the mercy of Arab oil-rich states. And there's a great deal of significance in that, as I've covered so many times in Daniel, the 11th chapter, about a jostling, a shoving, or a pushing by a king of the south in the Arab oil states or Egypt toward Europe, the king of the north. And then what happens in the Middle East that ignites the spark that could bring World War III? You need to understand, and the only way to get the overview for all of this is to have your name on the mailing list of The Plain Truth and to read it. There's article after article about the tests around the world and how they interrelate and how they interplay on everything else that happens. For example, will Korea be the next test of American will? That's in the current number of The Plain Truth. Right on the heels of the American debacle in Indochina came the ominous warning, there will be another test of U.S. strength very soon. That was said by Eugene Rostov, who served in the Lyndon Johnson administration, and he was the former U.S. Undersecretary of State. Well, anybody could have said that, because anyone could have at least just thought from the point of view of the North Korean communist dictator, what would he do immediately after the loss of South Vietnam, the capitulation of Cambodia, and Americans withdrawing from Southeast Asia? It would be exactly ripe for him to attack South Korea. And here in The Plain Truth is a picture of this UN-dug intercept tunnel used to detect North Korean infiltration tunnels across that demilitarized zone. Now, The Plain Truth covers also the dying momentum of European unity and what it's going to take to revivify or to revitalize that. It assesses the new era after Vietnam, the era of total uncertainty and reappraisal for the United States. You need to read that. Also about what the Filipinos are saying, in very sharp words for the United States from a Filipino journalist in the wake of the dismemberment of South Vietnam. The entangling alliances into which we have gotten ourselves are covered in the World Watch column by Gene Hogberg. And there's a very interesting analogy made even from back in the Bible about the soft-hearted Israelites who violated a principle about alliances and pacts with potential enemies. And about Britain, whether in or out of the common market, that only Britain can save Britain. There's the missing dimension in sex, the first of a series of articles taken from the editor-in-chief's book by the same name in the current number of The Plain Truth, and also pictures in an article by Arthur Fertig on Saigon before the fall. You can have your free copy while you're at it. Request the booklet, The United States and the British Commonwealth in Prophecy, that covers much of what I talked about in this broadcast. And all you need to do is to request it by sending your letter to Post Office Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. We need that. That's all. There is no cost, but tell us the name of the radio station to which you've been listening, the call letters, and then send your letter to Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales.